You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, we are back with another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is being recorded Saturday evening, the 11th of November, 2023. It'll be out a few days after this. As always, you know, I got a donation for $2. By a friend of mine. And like Christ said before, you know, for someone who can't afford it, that $2 means a lot. And he knows who he is. I want to thank him for that. And it really doesn't matter the size of the donation, but given the hours that I put in, you know, with minimal help, I mean, I don't have research assistants or anybody like that. I depend on you guys for my functioning and for my independence. In fact, today I had three specific topics to deal with. I had all three of them ready. I had to pick one. I don't know if you know this, but every time I go to do one of these, I change my mind as to the topic maybe 5 minutes before I start. I'm always working on more than one thing. Oh, and speaking of which, I'm thinking, don't hold me to this, but my book on China as a social nationalist country, not a Marxist country, which is a set of essays I've written over the last 5-7 years, and a lot of it concerning American foreign policy, should be out, I think, by the end of the year, if not very early, 2024. One of the many things that really irritate me is this hippie, peace-loving conception of Jesus Christ. It really is blasphemous. A lot of you have seen that picture of Christ. You see it in some liberal Catholics. He's smiling, big open mouth, toothy smile. The real stupid one of Christ holding the baseball bat for the kid. And, I mean, that might be Norman Rockwell-y. But this notion of Christ as this peace-loving hippie who just wanted everyone to get along is absurd, and it borders on the blasphemous. I want to talk about a variation of a criticism of that idea from the great Metropolitan Anthony Klapovitsky. It's an odd essay. I don't think it exists in English. If it does, I'm unaware of it. So I translated it recently. It came out in 1909, and it's the discourse against those claiming Jesus Christ was a revolutionary, that he's a Democrat, a liberal who just, you know, wants people to do whatever they want, so long as they're happy. And it's not an uncommon view, but equally as irritating the people who think that Christ is just can't wait to throw them into hell. No, he has elements of both, like any good father does. The Metropolitan Anthony, who died in 1936, was the first head of the Russian Orthodox Church in exile after the revolution. And he led the Russian exile church at an extremely difficult time in its existence, and of course was a part of pre-revolutionary Russia most of his life, Bishop of Kiev. So clearly he's dealing with a country that has within its borders a small but extremely well-organized and well-funded revolutionary movement, top-heavy with Jews, but you have other foreigners in there too. so many of those who defected from them talk about how Jewish it is and how secretive it is in terms of their doctrine. And Kropovitsky is worried about this because he is defending the personhood of Christ, which is being deliberately distorted. Every once in a while, politically, you get someone who thinks that Christ was a revolutionary, that he was a, that he believed in equality or something like that. He believed in non-judgment. You've heard it before. And Kropovitsky wants to take aim at this because it is a deadly distortion. The level of ignorance in the gospel is such that you could pretty much say anything and the average person is going to believe it. And he takes aim at this from a few different points of view, both his life, that is to say Christ's life, and his teaching. And there was nothing revolutionary, especially given the nature of the day and age that in which he preached. And he is quite the contrary to any kind of democracy or revolution. But Christ does teach, of course, about the enduring poverty and pain and sorrow. But none of this implies that revolution has anything to do with his teaching. These Christian revolutionaries may say, Christ might not be a revolutionary, but he was everywhere a defender of the common people. And that's why he was crucified. At the time of the writing of this, there was a priest, the last name of Petrov, who was defrocked at one point or another over this, maybe even by Anthony. And Kropovitsky quotes him. And this is what the guy says. Christ was a Democrat. The Black Hundreds held the field trial against him, sentenced him to hang, and hanged him. He also takes aim at the French writer Renan, who quite a bit presented the life and work of Jesus as a protest, in his words, a protest against power. And, of course, his crucifixion as a result of that protest against power. Dostoevsky actually talks about this phenomenon in the 1860s and 1870s. These ideas were widespread. On Dostoevsky, the boy Kolya Krasotkin, he read Alexander Herzen's The Bell, and then after reading it was totally convinced that Christ was a revolutionary and a socialist in the leftist sense of the term. So Kropovitsky is always trying to be even-handed, because for a lot of these errors, there's a tiny grain of truth to it. And he focuses on the Jews, both, in the Israelite sense, as well as their modern Khazar leftist sense. And talking about the old, the Israelites, very different group of people from today's Jews. But the Israelites, given their sense of self in the law, were absolutely hungering for national ethnic freedom under the Romans or anyone else. They were enslaved by Nebuchadnezzar, and enslaved is a strong word, 500 years before Christ. No, they did quite well in that empire, but that didn't take away the desire for freedom in Kropovitsky's mind. They were a defeated people for a while, but it didn't change anything. Interestingly, I think we've dealt with this before, the prophet Jeremiah was opposed to a lot of these movements for liberation and the proto-Zionist return to the land of Israel. Same thing for Ezekiel. The prophet Jeremiah fought people who wanted to have their own state again. Jeremiah asked them to submit to Nebuchadnezzar. This is why they threw him into a sewer. Jeremiah says, in chapters 26 to 38, Jeremiah talks about the time of political freedom for the Israelites was gone forever. And of course, the people, the elites, didn't listen to them. And what they ended up doing is entering into clandestine talks with the Egyptians, and with their help, overthrow Nebuchadnezzar, or at least escape him. Then followed, of course, the second and then third destruction of the country and Jerusalem. We know how this ends. King Zedekiah was taken, his children murdered, he was blinded, and a royal governor, Nebuzaradan, left in Jerusalem, leading to a tremendous amount of indignance and anger. They killed Gedaliah, the governor of that province. And actually, he was a son of Ahikam, who saved the prophet Jeremiah previously. So, after the captivity, the Jews, even though they had been already mixed in the exile, they still, as you know, my devotion to Ezra, they continued to drive for an ethnic and religious freedom, build walls around Jerusalem, etc. Again, that didn't work out. They fell under the control of the Hellenizing Antiochus Epiphanius, and they continued their drive for liberation. And that's told by the books of the Maccabees, sacrificing their lives, despite the fact they had few men and few supplies, fighting a very strong enemy. Of course, for a while, they turned out to be victorious. The Maccabees is almost unread, and I'm telling you, it's a very, very good book. It's like an action movie. The militarist, even self-sacrificial approach to warfare there is worth talking about. But the Prince of Judah was eventually impoverished. Judea was made a Roman province. The desire for freedom didn't go away. It's always one of the great foundations of ethnic nationalism for the church today. Now, prophecies both, the captive prophecies, I'm not talking about Ezekiel or anyone like that, but what eventually was encoded into the Talmud, the concept was that the Jews had to physically conquer all other nations and establish their rule everywhere. Now, at the time, the very early 20th century, when Metropolitan Anthony wrote, there were many Khazar Jews among the socialist revolutionaries. And to some extent, there was at least a journalistic transmission of that same mentality. He says, and this is Klapovitsky saying, at a time when revolution and ideas of freedom became the religion of the people, could a teacher who would himself demand such freedom be murdered by them? Now, he's talking about Christ here. In other words, you don't get oppressed by the people who love you. And that goes for everyone. You have people who are considered whistleblowers or rebels, who have, who are multimillionaires, like the Noam Chomskys of the world. Now, if they were a true whistleblower, they would be marginalized at best, and at worst, thrown in prison. Now, in Acts chapter 5, 36-37, there are two people spoken of, and that's Judas the Galilean and Theudas. And at some point, Theudas appeared, claiming to be someone significant. 400 men rallied to him. He was murdered, his followers were dispersed, and it all came to nothing. At the time the census was being taken, Judas the Galilean appeared and led a small band in revolt. He too was killed, and his followers were scattered. Now, why am I saying all this? What does this have to do with Christ being murdered, allegedly, by people who loved him. True rebels end up like the prophets. True rebels end up like Christ himself or Socrates. And yet, even at Christ's resurrection and ascension, the concept of Jewish domination, which had to be begun by revolution against whoever occupied them at the time, the Romans in this case, still, rose up with some courage, even though now their religion was obsolete. Jerusalem was, again, taken. The remaining Jews sent to Egypt, and they're scattering throughout the world, which is in fulfillment of Moses' prophecy. But all these disasters did not enlighten these people. 135 AD, yet another uprising of the Jews, suppressed by the Romans, and then the Jews as the same people, the Old Testament, according to Krapovitsky, scattered and ceased to exist. And that's a direct quote from him. Now, this concept that Christ was this kind of leftist hippie, and it was this even a pacifist, allegedly was killed by the Jewish elite, which of course I'll never admit, apparently for wanting revolution and hence Jewish independence. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Christ accepted death. He was a victim of the revolutionary movement of the Jews. Now, the problem here for Krapovitsky is that he's defining Christ the revolutionary as Christ the Jewish nationalist, which he obviously was not, quite the contrary. But at the time, that was the nature of revolution. Today, of course, they'll say that the Romans killed Christ because he was a threat to them or something stupid like that. Now, of course, Christ was murdered for a bunch of reasons, quite voluntarily. The greed of, Judas, the dissatisfaction of the Jewish elite, who, had a tough time to control him, violating the legal traditions of that group, and even Pilate just wanting to end the discussion. But those are strictly, they're secondary. Krapovitsky makes the argument that the most important reason that Christ was murdered was his rejection of revolution. Christ refused over and over again, in many different ways, refused to support the idea, as Jeremiah, same way, of overthrowing this foreign people, and then the political freedom that results from it. And that's what he's talking about in terms of Christ as a revolutionary. At the time, it would have been support political freedom for the Jews against the evil Romans or whoever occupied them. And of course, not only is that not true, that's precisely why, because he refused to talk about that he was executed. Krapovitsky says this is the main reason. I mean, let's accept the spiritual reasons, metaphysical reasons. This is the practical, earthly reason. And it's the exact same thing that led to the murder of St. John the Baptist. If you go to the web archive, a long time ago, I did a talk on St. John the Baptist. And I didn't realize just how much of social and psychological significance was in the story of his murder. And Christ himself indicates that this is very significant. Now, Krapovitsky says that after the transfiguration of Christ, the apostles came down from the mountain, the three of them, and reflecting on this, this is what they said, Matthew 17. The disciples asked him, "Why then do the teachers have the law say Elijah must come first?" Jesus replied, "To be sure, Elijah comes and will restore all things, but I tell you, he's already came." And they didn't recognize him. "But I've done to him everything that they wanted, in the same way the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands." Then the disciples understood he was talking about John the Baptist. So Christ indicates to the apostles the same people who murdered St. John will murder him and very possibly them. Herodias, who was angry at John for exposing her relationship with Herod, was armed against John the Baptist, and armed against him by the scribes as well, because he denounced them and diverted the attention of the people from political interests to an area of personal virtue in the sanctity of marriage. The Herodian party, which was not a popular one, it did come under the protection of the authorities, of course, but the Herodians were never put on a cross. You had a lot of unpopular people. John the Baptist was extremely popular. And yet, these people weren't herded to Gethsemane. I mean, anyone working for Rome was hated. Publicans, soldiers who were arrogant. It was a terrible assignment to be sent out there, you know, if you're Italian or Spanish. Even the contempt for some of the scribes and Pharisees. And it wasn't so much that they were preachers of some new truth, speaking in new terms like John the Baptist or Christ himself. Everyone expected the kind of what should we do question to be answered by some kind of political movement, to yet again go to their deaths against an enemy that they couldn't beat. But John went so far as to say in Luke, he says, whoever has two shirts, give them to the poor, or give one to the poor, and whoever has food, do the same in Luke 3. These kind of answers irritated the Jewish elite at the time. In fact, they realized that that kind of preaching was more dangerous than the Herodians, any of the tax collectors, or whoever. The expectation of this future revolutionary kingdom, these revolutionary plans, of course, they had a far more closer connection than any of the socialists of the beginning of the 20th century. So the issue, especially at the time, was reinterpreting Christ's words, trying to force him into a position where he would accept the physical kingdom of his own making. And even after the ascension, trying to interpret the old prophets this way. But what has to be understood is that the church is the spiritual kingdom. And the destruction, as you see in the book of Daniel, of previous kingdoms in a moral sense, it's kind of like the destruction of heresy. The captivating idea of this revolutionary nation or kingdom, the Jewish elite obsessed about at the time. The Jews were not, especially even, you know, in the Talmudic era, that they are meant to rule over the nations. And Christ, of course, said the exact opposite. Christ, as well as John the Baptist, many others, as Jeremiah, who I already mentioned, they were quite preoccupied with getting people to not think in purely political and physical terms. You know, according to the left, the socialists, again, the heavy Jewish influence, it is a materialist idea that as long as we arrange things in a certain way, we'll be okay. Christ called himself the Son of Man because he wanted to accustom the sympathetic Jews to understand the idea that the Messiah is a spiritual king. Daniel, in chapter 8, that the earthly kingdoms personified in those beasts we've talked about on the show before, they will fall, and then the eternal kingdom of the Son of Man will come into existence. Now, Klapovitsky was a royalist. But that's the royal kingdom was indirectly established by God. The church was directly established by him. The prophet Daniel wanted to show that the concept of moral perfection is more significant than, and that's actually what the ancient prophecy, the descendants of Abraham over all the tribes of the earth will be blessed. That's why Christ called himself the Son of Man. He was inserting himself, he did it literally, in this case, figuratively, to eliminate the secular idea of what the revolution was supposed to be. So, Matthew 26, the questioning by Caiaphas, he says, the high priest said to him, I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are Messiah, the Son of God. You have said so, Jesus replied. But I say to all of you, from now on you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. Now the high priest in this case perfectly understood what Christ was talking about, claiming that he was a blasphemer. Now he just repeated the prophecy, because almost everything that Jesus said harkened back to an early prophetic utterance. And the same thing goes for Stephen. Saint Stephen, the first martyr, said to the Sanhedrin, he said, behold, I see the heavens opened and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God, in Acts 7. The point of all of it is that the political materialist kingdom is not something to look forward to. It was the idea that the true teaching of the prophets about Christ, Christ himself, was to break their false teaching about the Messiah as an earthly monarch. Now, Kapovitsky also spent some time talking about how specifically Christ spoke when he was on earth. Sometimes, and critics have wondered about what, Christ sometimes used cryptic phrases. And the reason that they seem disconnected and weird in some cases is that Christ isn't just responding to a question. Sometimes he doesn't respond to the question at all. But he knows what's in the mind of those who are questioning him. Not to mention all the things that were excluded from the final text of the gospel that the fathers put together. So let me give you an example. Nicodemus came to Christ and said, Rabbi, we know that you're a teacher who came from God, for no one could do these kind of miracles unless God is with him. Jesus answered him and said, truly I tell you, unless someone is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. Which is a kind of strange answer. But the answer is in response to an inner meaning of what Nicodemus meant. The aspiration, the unspoken premise, the real reason he asked those questions. It was so difficult for them to recognize Christ as something other than an emperor, the deliverer of the Jews from Roman slavery. And they didn't see him doing anything in that regard. So the idea was, look, you're a great teacher, sent by God, but you're sent from God to free us from our enemies. Let's finally overthrow this pagan yoke. That's what was underlay Nicodemus' questioning. In fact, that was undergirded most questioning about him. That's why he has this, it doesn't seem that he even remotely answered the question. But that's the unspoken assertion. And that's why Christ said, to enter my kingdom, you must be born again. You cannot see this kingdom unless you be born again. It seems to be an odd conversation, but Christ, of course, has far more insight than we do. Then we know what happened there. Nicodemus says, how can a person be born when he's old? Can he enter the womb again? Now remember, that's because they still had this materialist conception of this kind of thing. Now, Nicodemus was a learned man. He knew what Christ was talking about. But how Christ spoke of his kingdom seemed just very bizarre to him and pretty much everyone else. Now, Jesus spoke of the moral rebirth within his church of anyone who comes to it. And that is a condition of entry into his kingdom. But remember, contemporary socialists still talk about the new man, which is just a secularization and a Judaization of that same thing. So reading Nicodemus's thoughts, Christ essentially said, actually, no, I'm sorry, he did say, we're not talking about what we don't know, but about what we know. Yes, revival, you know, according to the carnal understanding, is impossible. But that's why I came to earth. I know what I'm saying. Until now, it was impossible for a total revival of even an honest man. But I brought something new, new power. And I speak, being God, of course, from experience, from higher knowledge. Christ says in Matthew 3, he says, the wind blows wherever it pleases. You hear its sound, but you can't tell where it comes from or where it's going. So the same with everyone who is born of the Spirit. And then out of nowhere, Christ speaks about the judgment. Remember, Christ is responding to the unspoken foundation of a question, not the actual question itself. People often don't say the real reason why they're asking you something. Christ knew that. But in the Old Testament, things like judgment or justice were a bit different. We combine the idea of judgment with something terrible, something formidable. The whole problem of life, then, directly from this, is reconciling the idea, and you see this especially in Ezekiel. How do you reconcile the idea that the world has the righteous suffering and the wicked prosper? And you see this in Job. And here's Isaiah's answer to this very same issue with Nicodemus. Here is my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him. He will bring justice to the nations. He will not shout or cry out or raise his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out. In faithfulness he will bring forth justice. He will not falter or be discouraged until he establishes justice on earth. In his teaching, the islands will put their hope. And that's Isaiah 42. Now, this seems to be a wildly disconnected set of ideas, but they're not. The Old Testament thought always, and I've cited the prophets so many times now, there is this desire for justice. So, when Christ spoke about rebirth as a necessary condition for entering his spiritual kingdom, Nicodemus is thinking to himself, where is the judgment promised by the prophet that the Messiah will perform and dominate all over the nations? And that's why Christ says, God did not send his son into the world to judge the world, but that the world might be saved through him. Now, that's Christ's response to this thirst for physical justice. The judgment, which is very different from what had been understood up until this point, is that light has come into the world. But Christ says, people love darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. For everyone who does evil hates the light and does not come to the light lest his deeds be exposed because they are evil. But he who does righteousness comes to the light so that his deeds may be clear because they were accomplished in God. Again, it seems to be the last 10 minutes seem to be this patchwork. But all of this is an answer to Nicodemus. The prophet spoke of judgment, and it was about to come. Yes, Christ's answer, the judgment has already come and has arrived, but it is that light that's come into the world, etc. So the judgment predicted by the prophet has a moral foundation. The Lord came to expose falsehood. And the punishment that they'll have to deal with is not here. In fact, they will prosper. It will be elsewhere, which at the time, and even in our postmodern era, is unbelievable. It almost sounds like a cop-out. So far, then, the point is that you have this ancient drive for the Israelites for political freedom. And very rarely does that actually work out, going back to Jeremiah. Under those conditions, the patriotic drive was a false one, largely because of the intense corruption. What were they going to create? That's the passion, the interest. And inherently, there's nothing wrong with that. But given the circumstances, Christ's birth, in Christ's preaching. That was not the purpose. The spiritual nature of the kingdom, that is to say, the church, both on earth and triumphant, is far more important than any earthly kingdom that the Jews had expected, or that people expect now. How come Christ doesn't give me whatever I want? How come he allows suffering? It's all his fault. That isn't the topic. And Klapovitzky uses another example here. The conclusion to what I said here is that this is why he alienated so many people. You know, it's kind of interesting that you start a religion by alienating everybody, saying the opposite of what everyone expects. That's a very strange way to start a religion. Hence, to a great extent, it has to be true, because you wouldn't be doing that. Anyone who wants to start a religion wants to feed the passions, not fight them. But there's another one. The multiplication of the loaves and fishes. It's interesting, though. It three Gospels, he says, cover it. But in the Gospel of John, it's the full coverage of the thing is in the Gospel of John. It's mentioned elsewhere. And it wasn't as overwhelming as the resurrection of Lazarus or the healing of the possessed person. It's not one of those extraordinary miracles. It was a modest one. And those previous miracles, they were joyful, didn't have a clear connection with these aspirations of freedom. And that's always what the Jews at the time read into everything he did. The truth is that there was no chance of that kind of movement succeeding, and later years proved that. Even, you know, Judas Maccabeus. I mean, he couldn't succeed. He had no supplies. But now, wait a minute. Again, this is from the Jewish point of view. A teacher has appeared who can feed thousands of people with one word? That's why they, misunderstanding this, wanted to make him king. And that's why he left. He always snuck out, because he knew everyone was misunderstanding what he was doing. Keep in mind, the topic of this is that Christ wasn't a revolutionary, but this is the revolution that mattered at the time. Not only was he not a revolutionary, or a democrat in that sense of the term, but he was fighting it with all the methods that were appropriate to the population at the time. And in fact, in escaping, you know, what happened next? The Galilee miracle. The Jews and those in Jerusalem who were most hostile to him followed him. The advance, so to speak, part of the nation, with a thirst for rebellion against the Romans. Christ didn't get into the boat with the apostles after the miracle of the loaves and fishes, and yet he still ended up in Capernaum with them. And they say, "Teacher, when did you get here?" He says, "Very truly, I tell you, you were looking for me, not because you saw the miracles I performed, but because you ate the loaves and you had your fill." John 6. So far from the imagination of the common population. People thought of Moses and the manna from heaven. That was a militarist movement, a necessary one. So God says, instead of this sensual nutrition, he will give those who believe in him another kind of food. In John 6, this is what he says. "It is the Spirit who gives life. The flesh is no help at all. The words I've spoken to you are spirit and life, but there are some of you who don't believe." And Jesus knew from the beginning that those were the men who didn't believe, and it was them who would betray him. And then he said, "This is why I told you that no one can come to me unless it's granted to him by the Father." After this, many disciples turned their backs, no longer walked with him. So Jesus said to the 12, "So you want to go away too?" Simon Peter answered him, "Well, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life, and we have believed, and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God." And then Jesus answered that, "Did I not choose you, the 12? And yet still one of you is a devil." He spoke of Judas, son of Simon Iscariot, for he, one of the 12, was going to betray him. In the heart of Judas, after this conversation, according to Anthony Klapovitsky, there was a revolution, so to speak, that took place for the first time. In his mind, when from that very conversation he saw that the teacher who he had followed up until that point will not satisfy the passion for earthly acquisitions, earthly Jewish rule over the world, let alone, you know, rebellion against Rome. Jews as a whole, eventually they understood that Christ will not support any of this. The Jews were looking to kill him. That's why he didn't go to Judea in John 7. His brothers came to Jerusalem, even on the feast, secretly. And there were disputes about him at the time. And what Christ continued to do was say, this is a spiritual matter. This is not a political one. This is not a violent one. Not that those things are inherently bad. The Bible says, on the last day of the festival, Jesus stood and cried, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture says, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water." Given the mentality at the time, these were bizarre words. There was a lot of this oscillation between doubt and faith. No one has ever spoken like this before. Now, in response to this, Christ says something that doesn't seem connected with any of it. He says, "If you continue in my word, then you are truly my disciple, and you will know the truth will make you free." That's verses 31 and 32. Make you free? What are you talking about? They're thinking. There was this bewilderment. Wait a minute, if you're the Messiah, then why do you refuse to become the head of the liberation? Christ spoke of moral freedom. So many of the Jews already thought they were free in the sense that they were still under the law. This passion for political freedom, for revolution, democracy, so to speak. They had a superficial freedom. They had their own spiritual leadership. They had their own police forces. But they were convinced of the idea that maybe they had basic autonomy, but they were still, in fact, powerless. People are very dissatisfied with this. And are, you know, they take it very hard when anyone reminds you of slavery by saying the truth will make you free because you're not free now. The Son of Man will set them free. Well, we've never been anyone's slaves. We are the children of Abraham, they saw. Becoming free didn't make any sense to them. Understanding this, although it's not necessarily spoken to them, at least not recorded, Christ says, "Truly, truly I say to you, everyone who commits sin is a slave of sin." And the Jews were arguing amongst themselves, eventually grabbing stones to kill the man whom just a short time ago they wanted to make king over them. It isn't to say that this, you know, the politics and the economics was done in the Old Testament. That was not the point of Christ coming to earth. Of course, there's all kinds of political implications, having nothing to do with Jewish aspirations, though, at the time. But these are the things that intensify the hatred for Christ. You know, it's almost as if to say Christ is doing all, he has these powers that come from God, and he's not doing anything with them? He's not fighting our battles for us? But even certain disciples who thought that the kingdom of their liberation would come soon, what does Christ do? He calls them to Jerusalem for the resurrection of Lazarus. And then his disciples say to him, "Teacher, how long have the Jews been looking to kill you? You're going there again?" They were afraid to go. The only person who wanted to go was Thomas. The point was, of course, that he is going to his death freely. Judas, of course, we all know what he did. But one of the first things that Christ did, knowing everything, of course, that would happen to him, comes out and says, "Who are you looking for?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they say, and Christ says, "It is I." And what happens? They retreated back and fell. And the point of that was that it's not the impossibility of resistance that was the issue. This was very voluntary. Then he surrendered in fulfillment of the prophecies. Hatred and unbelief could not destroy his power. Physical things couldn't destroy his power. That's the problem with these materialist ideas, these leftist ideological concepts. Of course, not at the time, but, you know, the Khazar socialists then and now. And then he resurrects Lazarus in front of everyone. Remember, early on, his miracles were secret. Like, I don't know, the resurrection of the daughter of Jairus. And he didn't want these miracles to be told to anybody. Christ even would say, oh, she's not dead. She's just sleeping in Matthew 9. But this is different. He knows what's happening. He knows the contempt that's growing against him. And in front of a lot of people, Lazarus is risen from the dead, and Martha and Mary had already said that he was dead and already decomposing. Now, that miracle was different from the rest of them. The Jews at that point couldn't see anything greater than, you know, the conquest of all nations by the Jews, the Jewish truth and justice and the destruction of Rome and all that stuff. But this is power even greater than that. That the physical kingdom only exists before the grave. One day, death will reign over anything. What happens to this glory while the soul is judged? But in this case, look, the teacher rules over death itself. Who is this guy? And doesn't this mean that his word and teaching is true? The rational thing for them to say is that, wait a minute, let's abandon all of our previous aspirations and just surrender to this man. And then the line is, then many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what Jesus had done believed in him, and some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. That's when the sentence was pronounced on him. The battle, from our point of view, is against any revolutionary doctrine, any conquest, any resistance to Rome, the imposition of at least the Israelites over the entire world. That's when that section of elite Jews decided to kill him. The connection of Lazarus to eventually what happened to God is very important. The Sanhedrin pronounced their death sentence because of Lazarus. They had to deny it, of course. So they had to invent a reason to kill him. Now, Renan, who the French author we mentioned before that Klapovitsky really dislikes, of course, he denies that this miracle happened. So many of the moderns will do this. The claim was that Jesus allowed his friend to pretend to be dead and lie in the tomb, and then this imaginary, you know, thing was performed. And this is a great quote from Klapovitsky about Renan and other revolutionary writers in France. He said, true, Renan wrote for the French, for whom the distinction between lies and truth has been so erased that deception and blackmail are seen as normal, so long as it's beautifully executed. Anyway, of course, the interpretation doesn't make any sense. And in fact, when that was translated into Russian, that part of Renan's book was censored out. Everyone wants to make Christ a version of what they think he should be, to make Christ a gentleman. And then Renan says the reason for Christ's condemnation was the forgiveness of the sinner, that the Jews couldn't forgive Christ for this forgiveness, even though the forgiveness granted by Christ to the sinner was in full accordance to the Mosaic law. He's talking about, of course, the woman who was about to be stoned. That's what he wants to believe. Now, it's true. Deuteronomy 17, witnesses to a crime have to be the first to throw the stone, because they have to bear responsibility to the relatives of the murdered person if things go wrong. So when St. Stephen was executed, Saul, before he became Paul, was a witness to it. The witnesses, taking off the tunic, lay him at the feet of the young man named Saul in Acts 7. And he was an important character here. Stephen was accused of a terrible crime. Blasphemy. And that was punishable by death. So the tunics of the accusers folded at the feet of this person served as proof that they could not deny their testimony. It was like a pledge or a guarantee of their participation in the execution. So there was nothing, you know, problematic about saying, whoever is without sin among you, let him cast the first stone. That is actually a specific legal doctrine. But Renan and people like him at the time, he tries to make Christ into a feminist. But of course, we know that this is, you know, again, just reading back into history. But it is, in fact, raising Lazarus that caused the problem. Same thing for the resurrection. When Christ was resurrected, the chief priests and Pharisees, they had a meeting asking what they should do. This man does many miracles. If we leave it like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take possession of our place and our people. Of course, they were right. But if Christ has a power of life and death, and you follow him for that reason, then rebellion seems to be a trifling thing. This is about metaphysics. This is about the afterlife. This is about eternity. No one would really care about, you know, political issues at the time. Yeah, it's a revolution, but a very different way. It's a non-materialist, non-ideological form of it. This is why Caiaphas, you know, the high priest, said, you know, don't you think it's better that one man should die for the people rather than have the whole people perish? Which, of course, was solely in their self-interest. The anger of the Pharisees grew, because by the time of Palm Sunday, they had already planned on killing him, and even killing Lazarus, too. And Lazarus had to flee. And this is the church history rather than directly in the Bible. This is in scriptures, but not in the Bible. He ran to Cyprus, who became a bishop, and he wanted to lay low for a while. In fact, the first two evangelists don't explain why Palm Sunday happened. But they didn't want to expose him at the time, because they were after him as well. The fourth gospel, describing the solemn entry, you know, Palm Sunday, explained the reason that the people who were with him before testified that he called Lazarus from the grave and raised him from the dead. That's why the people met him, because they heard that he had performed this miracle in Luke 12. And what he seems to say here is that you know from the first Gospels how people meet Christ, but you don't know why. Now know that the people did this because they saw Christ perform such a sign. And of course, by that time, Lazarus himself was gone. So both the hatred of the elite Jews and the mob, who recently forced the disciples to keep Jesus from entering Jerusalem, disappeared completely under the influence of this miracle. That's where Palm Sunday comes from. Spiritual preachers, you know, you talk about the fickleness of the Jews, and this is true too. After Palm Sunday, so from Palm Sunday to Friday, they turned on. But Krapovitsky makes an interesting argument that I never heard before. And that is that it was much earlier than Friday that they decided to, I mean, they put a plan in place. By Thursday evening, the people were on Christ's side. The high priest had to look for him, and they, you know, alone and at night. It's contrary to law to try anyone at night. In other words, in secret. And then early in the morning, Friday morning, they went to Pilate to ask him to confirm their sentence. Now, if this was done secretly, why were there so many people at Pilate's residence on Friday? It's a question that I don't remember anyone else asking. There was a big crowd there. How could that be? Everything was done secretly. That was the whole point of arresting him at night. I mean, we usually think that the crowd gathered to see Jesus. And, you know, the people wanted Barabbas and all that, but that's not true. The attitude of the people toward Jesus was not hostile at the time, like those accusing Christ before Pilate. At first, everyone was silent. Then suddenly, they become frenzied. They start saying, "Crucify him." St. Mark has the answer to this in 15. Very early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders and teachers of the law and the whole Sanhedrin made their plans. They bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. "Are you king of the Jews?" asked Pilate. "Well, you have said it," Jesus replied. The chief priests accused him of many things. So again, Pilate asks, "Aren't you going to answer? See how many things they're accusing you of." Jesus said nothing. Pilate was amazed. Now, it was a custom at the festival to release a prisoner whom the people requested. A man called Barabbas was in prison with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the uprising. The crowd came up and asked Pilate to do for them what he usually did, Mark 15, 1-8. But there's still the question of what are these people doing there? The high priest and the Pharisees brought Christ to Pilate for some kind of trial. The people were there for something else. In fact, the only reason that the mob was there was to demand that Pilate maintain the custom of releasing one prisoner. They weren't hostile to Christ at the time. I don't think they knew he was coming. Now, when Pilate asked, "Do you want me to release the king of the Jews?" the high priest stirred up the population to ask that Barabbas be released. The people at the time were not hostile. They had gathered there for a totally different thing. They didn't even know that Jesus was taken into custody. But they figured Jesus would be released anyway, because he hasn't done anything. He knew, of course, the Jewish leaders hated Jesus and were trying to blame him, but no one thought it would be like that. Now, Pilate didn't want to release. He wanted to release Christ. He did everything he could to protect him. Last person he wanted to release was Barabbas. But why did the people want him? He was a robber, right? He was also a rebel against Rome. Directly stated, Luke 23:19. He was imprisoned for what we would call felony, rebellion, and murder. He was essentially a Jewish guerrilla. That's why they wanted Barabbas. They didn't see him as a bad guy. They wouldn't demand just like any old robber be released. And they were kind of surprised when Pilate wanted to release Jesus. And he gradually began, Pilate that is, began to become bitter against Jesus. He didn't have any problem with him. But the Apostle Peter in Acts 3, addressing the Jews, he says this: "The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of our fathers, has glorified his servant Jesus. You handed him over to be killed, and you disowned him before Pilate, though he had decided to let him go. You disowned the Holy and Righteous One and asked that a murderer be released to you. You killed the author of life, but God raised him from the dead. We're witnesses of this." So he's talking about that moment, Good Friday, the mob, having met Jesus, apparently hesitated. They weren't hostile to Jesus, but they did hesitate between the two. People began to demand the crucifixion of the Lord, but at a specific moment, when Christ returned from Herod in all those, you know, the clothes of mockery. That's where in the Gospel of John, that's when the crowd gets more and more wicked, more and more crazy. The scribes demand the execution of Jesus, then the mob does it. The people were perfectly fine towards Christ at that point. Then they become angry. Then they bring Christ from Caiaphas to Pilate's judgment seat. Pilate comes out and said, "What do you accuse this guy of?" And they said, "Well, if he didn't do something wrong, we wouldn't have delivered him to you." There you have really the answer to this talk's point. The clash between political Jewish movement for freedom and their actual condition to Rome. Now, it used to be the Romans would just, you know, rubber stamp whatever the Jewish elites wanted when it comes to these kind of things, you know, approving them with no dispute. But Pilate didn't want to do this. And that's why he said, "Well, take him and judge him according to your law." Pilate begins a conversation with Christ about the accusation. Are you king of the Jews? That's when Christ says, my kingdom is not of this world. He was born, came to this world to testify to the truth. So Pilate goes out to the Jews and said he found no guilt in him. Then he orders Jesus to be beaten, brings him out to the Jews wearing a crown of thorns and that scarlet robe, looking, because he'd been beaten so badly, he was just one big bloody body. And again, he says, I find no guilt in him. At this point, people haven't said a single thing hostile to Jesus. The soldiers, they wove the crown of thorns, placed it on his head. Pilate asks again, behold, I'm bringing him out to you. And the Jews see Christ coming out with that crown of thorns and that robe. And Pilate says, behold the man. It was a completely different story. One thing Pilate didn't realize, that you can't show to a mob like this in that condition, that's your king. People, of course, still wanted to see a real king, and they were silent at first. And then the high priest shouted, crucify him. Still, the people weren't screaming yet. Pilate again says there's no guilt in this man. That's when they say, according to the law, he must die, made himself son of God. The sight of the king of the Jews being spat on, strangled, beaten, humiliated, that was the insult. He destroyed Jesus in the eyes of the people. He appeals to the people for the release of Christ. Of course, the ruthless scribes, you know, they demand his execution. And without even waiting for their answer, Pilate tries to release Jesus again. And says, you are not a friend of Caesar if you let him go. And that becomes a problem. Christ is still standing there looking the way he did after his beating. Then Pilate makes it worse and says, here is your king. And from that moment, they called for his head. This is Jesus, the man to whom death itself was subject. He fed 5,000 people. When they came to get him from Gethsemane, one of the soldiers fell back. And now this same guy, he allowed himself to be mocked. And hence the idea of the king of the Jews to be mocked this way. The fact that the pagans did this, it was a desecration. That's why the fury seized the mob. And that's why they shouted, crucify him. It killed all the compassion for him. In other words, he allowed the national revolutionary idea to be outraged in tolerating all of that from them. Even when they say, you know, you come down from the cross, save yourself, all of this derives from that fact. I've never heard this explanation before. This desecration, this humiliation of the king of the Jews, who was a symbol of their of what they wanted. Pilate makes it worse by the inscription, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, hanging from a cross, bleeding to death. Then, of course, and that's, again, that's why people turned on him. They didn't understand why he would do that. And again, it's about the last way to form a church is to be humiliated in front of everybody, beaten almost to death. Now, I've already gone over my time. There's a lot of issues that I haven't covered here, as always. I think Anthony Krapovitsky, in my interpretation of him, I think the point has been made. By revolution, we're talking about this rule of the Jews, the rule of Israel over all the nations, the destruction of Rome. That's what revolutionary meant at the time. That was the popular feeling, and hence the democratic feeling. Not only did Christ reject that, that's the main reason he was murdered. And that's why in the very beginning I said, can someone who loves you and supports you, can he then turn around and say, be tortured to death? I mean, all other things being equal, of course not. It's like these official rebels, like Angela Davis, who actually murdered people and is still a heroine, as far as I know, still alive, with blood on her hands. What real rebel gets a tenured position? She doesn't even have an education at UCLA. No, that's because they're fake rebels. They're not actual rebels. That's why, you know, the battle between the political, ideological democratic idea of Jewish revolution on the one hand, and Christ's rejection of that, and St. John the Baptist's rejection of that, as a spiritual matter, beyond the demands of these arrogant people. Truth is, a hatred against Jesus arose among the mob because he didn't want to accept and lead the rebellion against Rome, allowed himself to be tortured in front of Pilate, of all people. Christ promised moral freedom, not political freedom. That's the Jewish mob gave way to total direct anger against him. He refused to be their earthly king. And when he raised Lazarus, their stubbornness started to be shaken. Then the scribes decided to kill him. Christ is captured, brought before Pilate in secret. The mob didn't know anything about this. They were there to intercede for Barabbas. And now they see Christ, the wonder worker, refusing to fight, allowing the pagans to violate the idea of the Jewish national king. Then the hatred began, and that's when the mob eventually demanded his death from Pilate. And this hatred was softened only at the descent of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost. And of course, the apostles also were murdered by the Jews overwhelmingly when that same mob saw in them an obstacle to this national movement. Obviously, you're thinking about the connections with modern Zionism, and you would be correct to say that, despite that they're two different groups of people. Now, of course, it wasn't Rome that killed Christ, it was the Jews. Pilate condemned him, but that wasn't of his own free will. It was a demand of the mob. He didn't want to be an enemy of Caesar and have all these people with some money condemning him to Rome. I mean, ultimately, it comes from the long-standing envy of the Pharisees against Christ. And that's why he was taken into custody. Of course, Christ needed to die on the cross, and that's why he allowed it all to happen. But that's where this confrontation, the tearing of the temple curtain, it was a battle between Christ's spiritual approach and the Jewish materialist democratic revolution. Now, despite the fact that the Israelites are not the Khazar Jews of modern times, it still is an ideological descent from one to the other, especially where Christ is concerned. And this is how Klapovitsky ends his article. Our fate is the same as Jesus's. Console yourself with this, as persecution is coming for us all. Remember how he, being crucified, prayed for his enemies. In Luke 23, all of us, when we have to endure hatred and ridicule for our faith and piety, say in your heart, Father, forgive them. They do not know what they're doing. And this was written in 1909. He knew exactly what was coming down the way, as Christ himself did. My friends, as always, thank you very much for listening, for donating, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.